Taken under advisement. Our fifth case for argument this morning is Dillard against Starcon International.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Kavanaugh, and I represent the plaintiff appellant James Dillard. In 2003, Mr. Dillard filed a lawsuit against his former employer, Starcon, seeking redress for race discrimination and retaliation, including and up to his discharge. He's asserted claims under Title VII and Section 1981. In March of 2005, as the close of discovery approached, the parties began discussing the possibility of settlement. When their oral and written settlement negotiations broke down, defendant Starcon moved the district court for an order to enforce an alleged oral settlement agreement. This is an appeal from the district court's order granting that motion and dismissing Mr. Dillard's claims with prejudice. We respectfully request that the court reverse and remand. The district court's order here should be reversed because it incorrectly applied the governing legal principles and ignored entirely significant aspects of the evidentiary record before the court at the time it made its ruling. The district court's order cannot withstand scrutiny, even under the more deferential abuse of discretion standard. In the underlying motion, the movement Starcon had the burden of proof. As the district court was being asked to summarily resolve the party's dispute, reasonable inferences should have been drawn in Mr. Dillard's favor. The evidence before the district court at the time that it rendered its decision consisted entirely of an affidavit and three declarations, in addition to written exchange of settlement correspondence. Illinois law provided the standard to which that evidence was to be held. To find a binding oral settlement agreement, Starcon was required to show two things. First, that the parties had manifested an intent to be bound by their oral agreement alone, and second, that they had a meeting of minds on all essential material terms. The district court erred in its application of both requirements. In its analysis of intent, when determining whether or not the parties intended to be bound by their oral discussions as of March 20th, the court improperly confined its analysis to simply the conduct of the parties up to and including that date. It ignored the parties' subsequent negotiations for more than 10 days thereafter. The court found because neither party had expressly stated to one or the other that there would be no final deal until a written document was prepared, that must have meant the parties intended to be bound by their oral discussions alone. However, this court's precedents make clear that a party's words and actions, both before and after the alleged oral agreement was created, must be examined to ascertain whether or not the parties had manifested that mutual intent to be bound.
Did you request an extension of the discovery time?
Plaintiff did not request an extension of the discovery
time. When did it run out?
It would have expired on March 31st of 2005, under the current order at the time.
So presumably, if we reinstated the case, discovery would now be impossible because the time had passed.
I think the parties would ask the court to continue.
But on what ground? The plaintiff was perfectly content to go to bed with no discovery, to let the deadline pass.
Well, discovery was underway, and some discovery had been taken. And both parties were negotiating further towards a final settlement agreement. Neither party had asked for an extension. The court did hold several status conferences and then ultimately a settlement conference before this motion was briefed and decided.
You set the deadline for discovery, or that you set the deadline for the entry of the agreement, settlement agreement?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You set the deadline for the response to settlement agreement?
No, defendant had requested at various times during the discussions that the parties had reached an agreement by a set point in time. At one point, it was March 20th at 10 p.m. We understand that, Your Honor. We don't believe that that is dispositive of whether or not the parties had an agreement. I mean, parties set artificial deadlines during settlement negotiations all the time, and that's what the court did.
But there wasn't any other artificial date other than that one, as you now have the record before us, right? That was the last agreed.
It wasn't an agreed deadline. That was a deadline Starcon had set in one of their communications to the plaintiff's counsel. And they did have a conversation that Sunday prior to the deadline. However, the district court stopped its analysis there, and that is where we think the court committed error. Because as the Orr case shows, when you look at the party's conduct following March 20th, you see ample evidence that neither party believed they were done negotiating or had a final agreement as of March 20th. Both parties understood that they were going to have an opportunity to present and negotiate over additional terms, which were, again, by their conduct following that point in time, objectively material to those parties. This court's decision in Orr, at a minimum, requires the court to have looked at all of the evidence and not just stopped at March 20th and determined as of that point whether there would have been enough to form a contract in a hypothetical scenario. It is required to look at what these parties expressed to one another throughout the entire time of their negotiation. And it is that post-March 20th evidence that is most dispositive.
One of the significant features about discovery. Right? There were things that needed to be done. If no settlement had been reached, there were things that needed to be done before the discovery deadline passed. And both sides stopped. Right? And that would imply to a reasonable person that both sides thought they had settled this case.
I think that I'm not going to say that that isn't a piece of evidence the court couldn't have considered. Of course it can. I don't believe that that necessarily means that that's what the parties thought. I think both parties believe they had made substantial progress in settlement negotiations as of the 20th and truly believed that they would reach a final deal. The fact that they didn't 11 days later, and that was the first time that the defendant ever made mention of the belief that there was a final agreement as of March 20th, it negotiated for more than 10 days thereafter, and never once
The defendant had given a drop-dead date, saying if we don't have a deal by X, then no deal. We'll finish the discovery, and it's off the table. And when you strike a deal on the eve of a drop-dead date, one would ordinarily think that you think you've got a deal.
I don't believe the record is that clear that what was communicated is we are not going to negotiate any further after March 20th. I mean, those statements were made. We have two affidavits that talk about that conversation having taken place. But if that was the case, then you would not have seen from the defendant the type of exchange of written settlement drafts that you see for 10 following days.
That's very common.
Pardon?
It's very common after an oral settlement agreement is reached to have an exchange of drafts and differences of opinion over drafts and that sort of thing.
Correct. And the court and the district court is required to determine whether or not those things that the parties are disputing afterward may be just immaterial terms incident to memorializing that agreement. I know it's not binding in this circuit, but the federal circuit's decision...
Or an effort by each side to see if the other can be made to give up something valuable. And that certainly looked like game playing was going on in the sense that each side, after the deal was struck, or so the magistrate judge found, then proposed additional terms in the hope that the other side would throw something its way.
That is how the district court may have viewed it. Our argument is only that the district court, by its order, there's nothing in there that indicates that it considered any of that post-March 20th conduct. And that if you look at it, the court could have undertaken an analysis of whether all those additional terms were material, but it didn't. It just said, because they weren't raised prior to March 20th, they must have been immaterial. And when you look at the exchange of correspondence and the drafts themselves, I believe the record is clear that StarCon itself believed many of those terms to be important and material, in fact, characterizing them as standard and pro forma and required.
Standard and pro forma. StarCon should thank its lucky stars that your client didn't sign because one of the terms they proposed is a federal felony. It's called obstruction of justice to pay somebody to withhold testimony from other judicial proceedings. If StarCon has got that in any of its other deals, its executive should wonder when they will need to report to the MCC.
That is one of the terms that we objected to, Your Honor. And in addition, it proposed terms that obviously, if you look at the written draft itself, it has a provision that says Mr. Dillard, if he signs this, is going to have 7 more days to revoke it. I mean, I think that is the type of evidence the district court should have considered that the parties did not have a final agreement. In their March 20th discussion, they ended by acknowledging there was going to be a preparation of written drafts. And that can be viewed two ways. It can be viewed either as we're going to just memorialize what we had discussed, or we're going to continue negotiations. And I think the Federal Circuit's decision in Department of the Navy that we cited isn't exactly on all fours with that. I see my time is near an end, so I'd like to reserve whatever I've left for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Cavanaugh. Ms. Kraft.
Good morning. Melody Kraft. I'm counsel for defendant appellee Starcon. And it is Starcon's contention that the key question before the court today is that the standard of review. And it is our position that in this circuit it is very well settled that a district court's decision to enforce an oral settlement is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. Pursuant to Hakeem versus Payco General, Wilson versus Wilson, and Carr versus Runyon. I think particularly instructive is this court's 2001 decision in Hakeem, also a decision on an oral settlement of a Title VII claim. That case involved...
Ms. Kraft, what do you think becomes of some of these terms that Starcon proposed and which the plaintiff rejected? I mean, the term, for example, that said, the plaintiff agrees to abide by any work rules we care to prescribe. So if he arrives on the job the first day and Starcon prescribes as a work rule, the plaintiff shall do 500 push-ups before beginning work every day and is fired if he can't do all 500. Is that now, as a result of what the district court has done, within Starcon's power on the first day, the plaintiff shows up back at work?
I don't think that would ever happen. That provision was that he would be subject to the same employee handbook, the same standard policies that everybody else was.
I don't think it said the same policies as everybody else. Just said he would be subject to work rules. And that, of course, sounded like a reservation of the right that we would have Dillard-specific work rules.
I don't think that was ever understood by either party to be the case. In fact,
then why didn't it say the same rules as everyone else? Because it surely didn't.
Well, that was the intent, and in all of the negotiations with opposing counsel and in correspondence, I attempted to make clear that all we were trying to do was hold him to the same standards.
Is it, by the way, the Starcon's corporate policy to try to get people to commit fraud as part of these?
No,
both obstruction of justice and fraud, because this deal proposed both obstruction of justice and fraud. The clause, I would agree to pay $25,000 if I ever assist anybody else or if I ever testify truthfully. And the clause, I acknowledge I have had 21 days to consider this. The first is a federal crime, and the second is fraud. Now, why in the world would Starcon propose such things?
Well, let me explain what the intent was. As to the ADA release, it was that under the ADA, somebody has to have 21 days to consider.
Yes, they have to have the 21 days. They don't falsely recite it.
We weren't asking him to sign the release before 21 days was up. He had the release. He had 21 days to consider.
I'm completely flummoxed. If this was a bona fide offer of 21 days to decide, then what the plaintiff did was say, I have considered and I've decided not to take this deal. Then there's no settlement and the case goes forward. But your client's view is that there was a settlement. It was binding. It was done. And, of course, that's what the argument was that was sold to the magistrate judge. That's completely incompatible with the assertion that the plaintiff has 21 or 7 or some other number of unencumbered days freely to say no.
I think it's two separate issues, respectfully, Your Honor. First of all was what did the parties agree to in the oral settlement? And that was very clear. The district court held that it was very clear that the terms of the oral settlement and it was that the terms of the reinstatement, that he was going to sign a release and that he would receive the monetary payment. That was the oral settlement. After that, parties are completely free to continue to negotiate terms in a settlement agreement release reflecting continued negotiations, and that's all the ADA provision was. Both parties agreed to that, and I think it's key that in terms of the actual statute cited to be released, it's the same in both parties' drafts. Returning to what I begin with, again, it's our key contention here that Hakeem controls, and in Hakeem, opposing counsel also attempted to convince the court that a de novo review should be considered, and this circuit clearly held that that was not appropriate in these matters and that the lower court's ruling is reviewed solely for abuse of discretion. Thus, we respectfully request the lower court's opinion to be upheld. I'll be happy to answer any other questions. Otherwise, we rest on our brief.
Thank you, Ms. Kraft. Anything further, Mr. Kavanaugh?
A few seconds left, Your Honor. I'd like to respond to one point, and that is this issue of whether or not the parties are free to negotiate additional terms or, in essence, modify an agreement beyond the point at which Starcon suggests an oral agreement had been made. The point that we're making in this appeal, Your Honors, is that the district court was required to look at all that conduct, not to draw an artificial line in the sand at March 20th and then engage in the analysis Starcon proposes. But if you look at the entirety of the conduct, you see that it is continuation of negotiations before a final deal is reached, as opposed to having struck a deal and both parties seeking somehow to modify that agreement. And if, as Your Honors correctly pointed out, the draft that they forwarded to our client makes clear that they understood the negotiations were continuing. Both sides, they referred to some of the suggestions Mr. Diller made as proposed substantive revisions. They understood that there was a negotiation ongoing as to key terms, material terms, to any final settlement agreement. They weren't willing to sign the document with Mr. Diller's revisions. There were things that they demanded be in there before they would sign any final settlement agreement. The fact that they later decided to change their mind and go back and enforce what happened on March 20th doesn't negate the materiality of those terms. Mm-hmm. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.